This episode is brought to you by DistroKid. Did you know that using DistroKid's Teams function, you can route any percentage of your track earning to a band member or collaborator? This is a free feature for all DistroKid members. Take advantage of this awesome function and so many more using our DistroKid discount link, distrokid.com/VIP/MPW.
This is MPW
the podcast with your host
Zylo Aria.
Cool.
A podcast about music production
for the everyday musician,
where we learn from experienced studio engineers and each other.
Susan Chiani is a 5-time Grammy Award-nominated composer, electronic music pioneer, and neoclassical recording artist. She was inducted into the First Class Hall of Fame of Keyboard Magazine and has received numerous awards, including the Golden Ear Award and the Seamus Award. Susan has provided the voice and sounds for Bally's groundbreaking Zenon pinball machine and created Coca-Cola's Pop and Pour sound. Hello, Susan. It's so lovely to have you on the podcast and such an absolute honor to be chatting to you. So thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Zylo. It's really lovely to be reaching across these huge distances to have a nice, intimate conversation.
Definitely, definitely. So how's your day been so far? It's the afternoon for you.
Well, let's see. Let's think about that. Tuesday morning is my meeting with my assistant, who lives in Berlin. So it's evening for her. You know, for you, we've covered the globe today. You're morning.
Yes.
she was evening. I'm afternoon.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that's always very intense because we try to cover, you know, a whole week's worth of detail in a couple of hours. So yeah, that's about all I've done today is be intense. Yeah. How are you?
Yeah.
How's your day? Oh, you haven't started
good.
Yet.
Yes, no, it's 8 a.m. in the morning, actually. And speaking of time changes, I actually missed a meeting this morning at 5 a.m. because I forgot that our time changed. So that was a bit embarrassing. But, you know, these things just happen, I guess, when you are working all across the world.
So you had a time change like daylight savings times or something like that.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay.
Exactly. Exactly.
That's all good.
It happens. But we're here today and it's great.
Great.
Great to be chatting to you. So before we get into technological advancements in music, and I'm very keen to get your thoughts on that, I'd love to know a little bit more about your journey, how it's turned out, and is that what you expected? I mean, yours was the first voice to appear on a pinball machine. You invented the famous Coca-Cola pop and pour sound.
First female voice.
Yes.
Although the voice that appeared before me was hardly a male either. It was some kind of a monster sound. But anyway.
Oh. Yeah. Okay, yes, first female voice, and you've been nominated for a Grammy Award in the New Age Album category 5 times. You've designed sounds for the federal government, I believe, for their flight simulators as well, and were also, I think, the first solo female composer to soundtrack a Hollywood film. So did you have these things in mind when you first got started in music and took your first steps in music technology, or did one thing just sort of organically lead to another?
I think there was an intersection of, you know, my need to make a living. So I studied music. I majored in music. I went to a graduate program in music composition. And then, you know, and I had a paid fellowship. And when that was done, there I was, penniless on the West Coast and saying, how can I make a living in the thing that I love? And so that was a baptism of sorts because I went out to make a living. I was a sound engineer. I had been trained as one, but I couldn't get a job as an engineer. There were just a lot of roadblocks. And simultaneously, I met Don Buchla and went to work for him. Now, it wasn't a very high-earning job. It was $3 an hour to assemble circuit boards and to work on the assembly line at his very informal workshop in Berkeley. But I fell in love with the technology at that moment. So just being on the inside and seeing these instruments and having access to Don's studio, which had, you know, towers and towers of modules. Another coincidence for me at that time was that I was near Stanford University, and I was able to study with Max Matthews, who was called the father of computer music. So he was out there for a summer, and I took a course. And also John Chowning, who is the father of FM synthesis. So here I was in this new corner of the world. You know, I'd come from the East Coast, I went to the West Coast, and I found myself in this cauldron, this very focused place. You know, even it is to this day a technology hub, you know, Sunnyvale and you know, so that's where I landed, in the hub of technology.
Yes, I'm sure, Ernie, that's kind of taken you in lots of different directions, and it is something that we hear a lot on the podcast, is it can be hard to know, to get a clear kind of path in music, and you end up doing a few different things and then ending up where you are as well.
Well, let's just start saying it's a very long journey. So here we are with the perspective, looking back at, you know, I'm in my 70s. So looking back at a long trajectory, a long journey, and telescoping it into a few things. But in fact, the journey is very long, and it's very exciting, and it's very unknown at the time, because technology, you know, if you choose technology as a field, it is an unknown. It's filled with surprises. It's alive and moving, and it's moving faster now than it ever moved. You know, you wake up and there's something new, but that's the inspiration of technology. Keeps us alive because we're stimulated by these new discoveries. And I'm sure there are a lot of fields like that. I suppose car making is like that. I don't know. But anyway, it is, you know.
Yes, ever-changing.
It's ever-changing. And, you know, for me, I kept bumping into walls. I didn't know where I was going, but I always, you know, out of hunger on some level, you know, needing to be independent, because that was my operating system. I was, from the beginning, a person that loved her independence. And so I really wanted to control my life. Technology gave me the ability to do that, to be independent. And I think that's a very powerful muscle that can work for you, you know, when you're committed to your own independence.
So what would you say is one event that you feel you've learned the most from in your life, Susan?
Well, okay, what pops up right now? Because we're talking to women, right, and about women, something that comes up for me is when I first worked for Don Buchla, I had this hunger to learn more about the technology. And this was at a time when there are not even any books on music technology. If you picked up a book on electrical engineering, it didn't have anything to do with what I was interested in. And so I asked Don if he would teach a class. I could follow the schematics. I could pick up the resistors and solder them into a circuit board, but I didn't really know what it all meant. And so we started a class. And I remember it was in this dark room, no windows, and we were all sitting there. And Don, who is not a very, social person, you know, he was a quiet introvert, but he did give us this class. And after the second class, I was told, don't take this personally, but we've decided that no women are allowed in this class. Now, what did I learn from that? At the time, I was shocked and how can I not take it personally? I'm the only woman in the class. How can you say it's not about me? And it took my whole life to understand that it wasn't about me. It was about the discomfort that men felt having a woman in a perhaps challenging intellectual position for them. And, you know, they really did have to be the dominant force. And I think once I left, you know, one of them, when he asked what color an electron was, and I, you know, I mean, maybe I was being, you know, I was just being myself, but obviously I made some of the men uncomfortable being there. So that gave me the wisdom over my life to see that men really don't specifically think less of women. They're just uncomfortable. They have a club. They have a highly developed club. They were comfortable in it. And all of a sudden, they're being asked to share that club. And they're just not prepared to do it. And I think women understand that now because we have our own shared conversations and clubs and, you know, and we also aren't anxious to include men in that. It's not that we don't want to include them. It's just that we never even think about it. You know, let's get some men in here to talk about. Yeah, no. So I think women have suffered because they were outnumbered and they were in a situation that made men uncomfortable. And so maybe the men overreacted or just expressed their discomfort, and that made women feel uncomfortable also. So now, you know, we can share with each other. We can feel safe. We can feel, you know, that we're learning, but we don't have to go through the dynamic of tiptoeing around egos that we don't understand, I guess, you know. But that was a lesson I learned. But as I say, it took a long time for me to learn what that was about.
There's a book that I really love actually called The Four Agreements. And one of the aspects of that book is very hard to achieve, but it talks about not taking things personally. And from what you mentioned there as well, they mentioned, which is a very hard thing to do because how could you not? But even then realizing it's not about you at all, but it's about them and their view on the world that's made them act that way. And I wonder, did anyone feel bad about that later on? And I don't know, did you get an apology at any stage?
You know, I reconnected with Don Buchla after, you know, being gone. I lived in New York for 20 years and then I came back to California and we reconnected. And I don't think I ever brought that up, but we were much better friends later in life than we were in the beginning. I think that evolution of comfort really happened from the 60s to the 90s. You know, there was, it was transitional time. And, you know, the 60s were the beginning of one of the waves, the crest of a wave of women's liberation here. They were burning bras and, you know, making statements. And, you know, that time wasn't aligned with it. I was too young. I didn't know that women had problems. You know, I'd gone to a women's college. Everything was fine. I grew up in a family with four sisters. Everything was fine. And then I come out and I understand from Women's Lib, which was starting then, that there were problems. So it took me a while to align and see and become aware of the issues.
So changing tact a little bit, can you tell me one random fact about yourself, Susan, that maybe not that many people in the industry know about you?
Let's see. I was thinking about this. I mean, what can I say? I'm allergic to red wine.
Oh. That is a random fact.
Yes, it is a random fact. And unless it's very old and very expensive. Let's see. I have two cats. I mean, I don't love cats. I mean, I never wanted a cat. They just come and they live with me. I've never gone out to get a cat. They just appear in my life. So, you know, and there's been a steady, you know, over the years, I've lived here for over 30 years and there have always been cats here.
Oh.
And I guess another thing is that I have a passion for black and white photography. So when I lived in New York, I started to collect prints from the 20s and 30s. I had taken a photography class in the summer before I went to college. And in the darkroom, you know, I loved that experience. And then I just became enamored of that period and the quality of prints. You know, I'm not about the picture, I'm about the print. And that became very, very directive and important for me because while I was in New York and collecting photographs, I would go to auctions and without any effort, I noticed that a lot of my collection was of female photographers. So I do have Ansel Adams and I, you know, because he's a consummate printer. But my favorite artist was somebody called Ilse Bing, I-L-S-E-B-I-N-G. And somebody that I met said, would you like to meet Ilse? And I, you know, I had no idea she was in New York. I said, yes. And he brought me up to meet her. She was already over 80 years old. And she became my mentor because I didn't know any women in technology. Mm. And I saw her art form, the printing, the camera. She was called the queen of the Leica when she was young. So she came from Germany, from Frankfurt. Then she went to Paris in the late 20s. And she became, you know, she always was a serious photographer, but she also did commercial work, as many photographers did. She worked for, Vogue and Harper's Bazaar and, you know, all the fashion magazines and newspapers. And we had conversations that inspired me completely because, you know, when you're young and you're female, you can easily get distracted by emotional issues. Boyfriend, men, having babies, doing this, whatever it is that women get preoccupied with. And with Ilse, she was a woman, maybe because she was over 80. When I talked to her, the first thing she would say is, Suzanne, tell me about your work. And she focused on my work. Nobody thought my, you know, there wasn't like a lot of feedback that said your work is important or your work is, or, you know, she kind of situated my mind in a new context. And I so identified with her. You know, she had been very successful in Paris. And then the war happened. She was Jewish and she had to leave Europe. So she was, you know, a star on the rise in Europe. She got out, not easily. She did get out. She landed in New York and had to start her life all over again. And she said, you know, when I originally came to New York, I was a star. They were feting me because I was having an exhibit, a show at an important gallery. But when I came after the war, nobody, you know, there was nothing for me. She said, the people that I knew, she needed to make a living and she became a dog groomer. So she, you know, she took care of animals and the same wealthy people that used to give parties for her now had her coming in the service entrance and being a servant, really. And she absorbed all of this, you know, without skipping a beat. You know, she was always a very positive person. And the one thing that scared me about Ilse was that she gave up photography. She gave up photography when she was 60. And I didn't understand this. I thought, you're the artist. You're the queen of the Leica. You're the one who loves, you know, you make these magnificent prints. And it took me, again, a long time to understand that she never gave up her creative spirit. It's just that her vision became bad. She couldn't see in the dark room. It wasn't suitable for her to do that anymore. And she moved over into doing collages, where she would take her old prints and reassemble them artistically. But there was never a worldly appreciation for her collages the way there was for her photography. But that didn't bother her. You know, I always worried, and I think my artistic life, I kind of psychologically mapped it onto her timeline. I thought, oh, what's going to happen to me when I'm 60? Am I, you know, you can't. And I understood that she never did give up her art and that I will never give up my art.
Yeah, for sure. So getting into our topic today, Susan, which is the impact of technological advancements in music. I guess when you first got started in the world of music, music technology and synthesis in the late 60s, early 70s, I believe, synthesis was such a new field in music. So can you tell me what was the general feel around that technology at the time? Were people excited by it? Was there some fear around it?
Well, you know, I was incubated, you could say, you know, very intensely in Don Buchla's studio. And then I, you know, I really fell in love with that machine and I really lived with it. And so it was a true partner for me. And so when I went out into the world to make a living, I was always bumping up against the fact that nobody understood it. They didn't know where the sound was coming from or what it was. And so I guess I was a little uncomfortable because of that gap of understanding. And I developed a kind of educational side to myself. You know, I decided, oh, you have to be very patient. You have to talk to people. You have to explain to them what's going on. There was no shared understanding of any of it. I'd come from, you know, I was 100% into this machine and I stepped out into the world and it had never been seen before. So there was a huge gap. But by the same token, in the music world, in all of its different formations, you know, there was music in film, music in television, music in games, you know, just starting, and music in records. All of those places, I found people who are very receptive to the emotional part of it. You know, I could give meaning to and enhance whatever it was they were doing. If it was Coca-Cola, I could make a sound that sounded like Coca-Cola. If it was a film, so one of the early films was The Stepford Wives. And, you know, the film scores at that time, this was 1975, you know, if you had a composer for a film, they were working with orchestra, but they were open. People wanted to try something new, even if they didn't understand it. You know, that was about the period when I was trying to give Buchla lessons to Philip Glass. He was interested, and it wasn't for him. But I found, you know, because I was fearless in those days, I don't know where I got that, but I recognize it, even looking back. And I think it was because I had a mission. You know, I was in love with this thing, and I just wanted to express it and do it. And so I did in many, many areas. But my first love was live performance. You know, Don Buchla, he kind of pretty much said that the Buchla 200 was a performance instrument and nobody was performing on it at that time. But I came under his spell and I worked on performing. But there were many, many uses for that machine, and I found them all, you know.
Okay. So it sounds like although there were a whole group of people that didn't understand it at all, that there was also some excitement about it. And you mentioned with the film composers and Philip Glass as well, that there was some interest in understanding it and being open to something new as well, which is great to hear. And I guess now in music, we're sort of at this, I feel, change in time as well, like with new technologies coming out, with the introduction of artificial intelligence in music. How do you feel about this, having gone through a few changes in the industry yourself? Like, does it feel similar to maybe the synthesis era and technology coming into music then, or is it quite different?
I think you have put your finger on a certain parallel moment historically. Mm. When electronic music came in, when these machines came in, there was a lot of fear. I mean, there's fear in the industry because they thought, as they do now, that traditional methods of, you know, making music would be replaced. The musicians would be replaced. I mean, when I came to New York in 1974, I wasn't allowed to join the musicians' union as an electronic musician. They weren't allowed. It was too scary. So I joined as a pianist. And I, you know, then I just used the synthesizer. But they in fact had a punishment. They didn't want people using electronic instruments because they were afraid that they would replace. This was all a misunderstanding, but they thought that they would replace traditional instrumentalists. And so they made this rule that if you did play synthesizer, you had to be paid double. They didn't want you to hire a synthesist to cut corners. So I made much more money. Than also, every time I overdubbed, I had to be paid again. So, you know, if they liked a sound and then they wanted another sound. So I would be paid multiple times, you know, on a contract. And that was out of the fear. You know, they didn't want to encourage this new whatever it was. So that was, you know, an interest, fear. Fear is based on the unknown. We're always afraid of what we don't know. So we don't know what's going on. But the other thing in that respect is that when I worked at Stanford and the artificial intelligence lab at that time, this was very early, you know, use of computers. I mean, they were starting what you could call video games, you know, but there was no video. But they were making shooting devices. You could shoot at a target with the computer. The computers were not real time. So when we did music, we had to specify a lot of calculations, deliver it, and get the result the next day. So it came back on a tape. It had to be calculated. It was a different world. But one of the things that was already happening back then was somebody saying, oh, let's use this to write music. And a guy came up with an invention. It was called a banal tune generator. And so way back then, you know, they would analyze patterns of melodic notes and feed them in and try to get, you know, some kind of an expression based on that. I mean, you could do that today. You could take all of Mozart, feed it in, see where harmonically he goes. But the thing that we have to realize is that art really is life. The reason we are attracted to art, and, you know, it is a living form. It's organic. It contains life. It contains the energy of the creator. And you can make replicas, you can feed in prompts and you can get out something, but that is not soul. That is not the heartbeat of what art is. And so it can be fascinating. You can look at that and say, oh my God, look at that. It made a sculpture. And gee, it did. That looks like a human, you know? But if you compare that with a sculpture by Michelangelo, you know, it's just another world. So yes, we can, this is a problem that we have now, is that distinction between the reassembled data that produces whatever visuals or sonic material or writing by reassembling something that you feed it. It just doesn't, it's a form of entertainment. It is something that you can look at, listen to, and read, but it will never be on the level of the we, you know, our artists, we have a lot of artistic talent in human nature. But if you look at the history of humans, there's a handful. I mean, there are these high moments of creativity. Bach, Beethoven, Mozart. I mean, not just because they're Western musicians and I know them. I mean, I'm sure they're all over the world, but it's not an everyday thing. So if you're making an everyday thing and you're 3D printing, whatever it is, you can get something, but it's not going to move you or speak to you the way something that is trying to communicate something. Art is communication. It's, you know, from one soul to another. It's not just the appearance of data. So there's no fear. It's a tool. It's a wonderful tool. The same way electronic music, you know, I mean, it has its own identity. My objection in the early days of understanding electronic music was that they really didn't understand what the tool could do, because they saw the tool through the filter of their own existing viewpoint. So they saw the tool as something that sounded like a flute, sounded like a violin, could replace a flute, could replace a violin, was a, you know, recreated something that we already knew. But in fact, it was a new language. We're looking at these things through filters of fear and filters our limited understanding, because, you know, we only know what we know. But so that's one aspect, is to give the freedom to the thing to develop on its own terms. And then we'll discover, you know, it's a wonderful tool. I mean, the synthesizer is a tool. It's an instrument. Without the person composing or playing or performing, the machine, it was just looking at this, and we can talk about this later, but the Sphere in Las Vegas. Do you know about that? It's a new theater. It's a big dome, and it has, you know, gajillions of LEDs, and you can program, you know, computer visuals. And it's like, it doesn't connect. I mean, you can be awed by all those lights, but it is not, it wears thin very quickly.
Well, there's a few things you mentioned there. Firstly, that you mentioned there's nothing to fear, which for me is great to hear, because I feel like I also have a little bit of fear around this. And like you said, it probably is a lot around uncertainty, because I'm thinking, what if this thing comes in and then we're not able to do the things that we love to do anymore? But there are a lot of assumptions behind that, where it's going to go, which we can't really know. But what do you believe then could be a space for AI in music, or is there one, and where would you see that sitting?
Art and the creation of art is a very personal thing. You know, the artist, I see it that way. I see the artist as somebody who has something to say, not just something to make, but something to express, you know, through a form. And that's the difference between like Jackson Pollock throwing paint on the floor and somebody else dropping paint on the floor, and are they both great art? Well, you know, one of them has something in it that, I mean, you know, there are all these experiments with art, you know, having spider droppings and this and that, and, you know, is it art? And like, if it's, for me, even my feeling about photography is that it's not about the picture. People say, oh, what a great photo. It's not about, oh, that's a pretty composition. I mean, you do need good composition, but that you could do with AI. You know, you could analyze composition and reproduce it, but that's not it. So there is something that communicates. I mean, everything we talk about has exceptions and overlays, and, you know, nothing is purely anything. Right. We're just talking about, I guess we're just trying to make some kind of pathway through a huge amount of thought. But I think that, you know, even when I look at my sister as a painter, and when I see her paintings, I am moved, not because she's my sister, but because, yeah, maybe because I know where they come from. But then I'll go to an art show and I'll see, you know, competent placement of color on, you know, something. And there's no life there. And I don't think you can define it. It's like, we don't know how to define life even now, but we know when it's there. It does communicate. So there's no way to do it by the rule book, because it's not about doing it right. There is no, you know, good art or the way it should be done. It's language and it's communicating. You know, if you have something to say, this is my biggest, you know, you say, what are my words of wisdom? I mean, having something to say. And if you have nothing to say, don't worry. Wait until you do. You know, I see artists, you know, pounding themselves over the head. They can't come up with anything and they don't have it. And it's like, yeah, well, go out and live life. I think it's easier in a way to have experiences, new experiences when you're young, because there are so many experiences to have. And as you get older, you know, you've had a lot of them. And I think instead, as you get older, instead of going out here or there in motion to get an experience, you find out that you can just sit in one place and everything changes. You don't have to go out to see something new. It's all new all the time, right where you are. Do you know what I'm saying?
Potentially.
Right. You're so young.
Maybe I haven't had enough experiences there, Susan.
That's an age thing. Yeah. Okay. Go out and have fun.
Yeah, but no, have loads of experiences. That's good when you're young. So tell me as well, Susan, I guess you've been the first female in so many areas with relation to music technology. You started your own business as well, Chiani Musica, which I'm sure was extremely rare as a female musician at the time. So how did you deal with the naysayers at that time? And even now, you know, a few years ago, I've been in plenty of rooms with music producers where I'm still one of the only few women in the room. And I do find it to be quite an intimidating space. So, yeah, do you have any thoughts on how to deal with that?
I think you deal with it the same way that you deal with, you know, say sexual harassment on any level, is you don't respond to it. You don't give it credence. You don't give it energy. You don't react. If somebody, you know, if somebody says, I used to have this guy, you know, I had a studio with him. And every time I walked into the studio, he'd say, nice legs, Chiani. And it would just make me curdle inside. You know, I just hated it. But I absolutely, like a duck with water off its back, I didn't react. And I just, you know, it's just not there. It doesn't exist. It doesn't exist. Same with business. If somebody treats you in a less than respectful way, I just hold my self-respect 100%. I don't react and feel lesser because that person wants me to feel lesser. You know, why do they want me to feel lesser? So they can feel more, you know, whatever that is. And it's not it's a subtle sense of your own self that you're not defined by what's out there. You know who you are and you just be. So a lot of it, because I trained myself not to react and not to notice, I was really oblivious to it to some level. I just went for, and I had, you know, those instances where suddenly I was shocked that somebody was, you know, putting me into a box that I didn't like. But, you know, it doesn't work to, I'm very practical. You know, if it doesn't work, don't do it. You know, what can you do? I mean, I've had, you know, as I'm sitting here talking, I'm thinking of all the times that somebody just didn't want me to be who I thought I was and just move on. And sometimes doors close because of that. But there's always another door that's going to open because of that. That's how electronic music opened for me, because they were closing so many doors. Oh, you can't conduct. Women have no right on the podium. What's wrong with women? They can't write long pieces of music. There are no women composers. Yeah, I mean, all of this stuff. And so you just, okay, you take it in and then you find another pathway. And the other pathway was technology. There's a lot of freedom in technology because you are defining, you can do it all. You know, technology has given us, you know, you can sit and 3D print your whole house. I mean, you know, it's given a lot of power to the individual.
Oh, like so many things that you mentioned there. It's a hard thing to cultivate, I guess, maybe comes with experience on ignoring the situation and realizing that you're just giving power to that person if you react and to just let it go. But it's a great thing to be aware of and to try and practice more.
It's complicated. I was teaching a class at Berklee College of Music. You know that school? Okay, music technology. And they said to me, you know, one year, they said, why don't you teach a women-only class? And I thought, well, that's not fair to the men. You know, we're going to exclude men from our class. And I thought, well, okay, if that's what you want to do. And it was amazing to me because I thought, because I came up in the 60s and 70s, I thought that a lot of this was history now, that the way this relationship between men and women in the workplace. And as soon as we got into a room alone, the women just spent the entire first 2 hours just unloading all of their frustration, their anger, their, you know, their helplessness at the way they were seen and treated. And it was even complicated because there was one girl there who was wearing a very, very sexy outfit. And in my day, we used to say, listen, if you don't want to be bothered, don't dress in a certain way that arouses comment. And she was saying to me, but you know, this is who I am. I'm an artist. I'm a performer. This is me. And I thought to myself, okay, I get it. We're not talking about you're a lawyer on a Wall Street firm. I mean, you are a self-expressing young musician and you see yourself this way. And I say to her, all right, but you have to be prepared that you're going to elicit some, you know, comments and reactions that you're not going to like. And so you have to be prepared to not have that be about you. It's not about just what we were talking about before. It's about their discomfort or their feeling they're supposed to do something. Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. So on that actually, Susan, what would you say for women that are getting into this space? And it is sad that we are still having these conversations because, you know, music production for women wouldn't exist if there wasn't a need for it. And I hear so many of these stories all the time. But for women entering the music tech space for the first time, what would be a couple of your top pieces of advice?
One, I think it's a good time for women to cultivate the company of women. So, you know, I'm working on a project now and I need a geotechnical engineer. And here I am at this stage of life and I'm really having trouble relating to these male dominant engineers. And I wish I could find a female geotechnical engineer. And in fact, that's what we need to do. We need to network amongst ourselves. We have a critical mass now. You can find all the things you need. There are women designing electronic music instruments, there are women engineers, women masters, women, you know, there are women. We need to network and cultivate those relationships. And that will, you know, unfortunately, at the end of that process, we're going to look just like men, which is we're going to feel more comfortable with women and we're not going to want men in our group. And it's like, I mean, yeah, I guess that's okay. But I think men are maybe a little bit different now too. You know, the young men they see women differently. I think it's the older men, you know, people get stuck in their generation viewpoint.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's true or not.
For sure.
there's a terrible, really, dearth of women in production. I think that is the most lacking field in all of music is the production area of music. There are no producers. Why is that?
Yes, and we've come to this question a few times in the podcast and also in our courses and things. And I think there are so many aspects to this, and, you know, one of them just being that the way our society has been probably for hundreds of years, and the gender roles that are attached to male and female, and then also, which is fascinating thing as well, when we talk about role models and not seeing people that look like you in this space and feeling like it's not a space for you. So I always wonder how pioneers such as yourself, how did you get into this space? You know, there was no one that you could look up to, and that seems to be a big issue as well. And yes, lots of different aspects to it, I think, that need to be addressed in very different ways.
Well, my role model was not in music. So you can find a role model someplace. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that's a really good thing to note as well. And they don't have to be in your field if you can't find someone in your field, but someone that inspires you, that's done something, you know, maybe in a similar field, as you mentioned, with photography as well. So at this stage, Susan, I feel like there's so much more that I could be learning from you, but I've gotten so much already, and I'm sure our audience has as well. So thank you so much for your insights there.
Thank you, Zylo. It's been so much fun just chatting with you.
Yes. That's it. But now we are at our speed quiz. Susan, are you ready?
Okay, well, I don't know. What is the quiz about? How old?
So it's five quick fire questions, and it's just a this or that, the first thing that pops to your mind. So let's go. One, cold weather or warm weather?
Warm weather.
All right. Festival or rave?
Festival.
Okay. Animals or people? Actually, I'm going to change that to you. Synths or people?
synths.
Very good. Live DJ or live band?
Neither. I don't know. Okay. Live DJ or live band. You know, to me, that ticks a historic thing, because all the live bands that I like are historic, and the live DJs are what you find now. So I think it depends on, you know, what period of history you're talking about. If you're talking about right now, it's live DJ. Yeah.
Okay. Live DJ. Melody or lyrics?
Melody, of course.
Okay. Excellent. That was
wasn't hard.
Almost speedy.
Well,
no, it's very good. Very good.
All the, you know, extra 5 minutes.
So that's all good. So coming to our top tips, what would you say is your one top career tip?
Well, I know this is very trite to say follow your heart or follow your passion. But without a passion for something, you won't have the energy to follow it when it gets rough. This is like the power of love. You know, it's like the things we can do when we are in an energy system of love are so much more powerful than we encounter without it. So, you know, if you can find love in your work, it's going to take you the distance.
Yes, no, it is something that you hear often, but I think it's not done often enough by everyone. So it's a good thing to repeat there. And, so I love that.
And let me just say that it's not always a direct thing. It can be indirect. It's like a mother with a child now loves her work because she can provide for the child that she loves. Mm. So it may not be, oh, I love getting up at 6 a.m. and going to work. It's what you know, what it's connected to. So, you know, for me, you know, my goal was to, you know, again, goals change. At first, it was to make the money so that I could get an instrument. Therefore, I loved the instrument, and therefore, I loved doing the work that would give me that. So it's not like you have, you know, you have to have a cause.
No, that's great. Great tip to mention there. And what is your one top self-care tip?
Aha. Well, I'd like to say get enough sleep, but I'm really a terrible sleeper. So it's terrible. But I do believe in exercise. So I exercise every day. I either play tennis or I walk 2 miles a day or I do my Pilates or I do, I have to live in my body and I want to take care of my body. So, taking care of your body.
I love that. Very, very important there as well. And the earlier we can realize that, I think the better as well. So the last one is, what is your one top general life tip?
My one top general life tip is trust yourself. You are the one who cares and about yourself, and you can trust yourself that you're going to do what needs to be done. We worry so much about, are we doing it right? Are we doing it? Da, 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 all those little things. And in fact, if you could just get out of the way with all that noise about, am I going to be doing it? Can I do it? Will I do it? And just trust yourself that in fact, you're going to do it. Like when I did my first album, I had that mantra and it said, there is nothing to do and everything will get done. So that phrase took all the anxiety out of feeling like you had to do something. And you went into a space where you just allowed the doingness to do itself. It's a form of trust in your own ability, and it just brings you into the present, because otherwise we're not in the moment. And to create, you really do need to be in the moment. You can't be in fear. You can't be in thought. You're just doing in it. It's like dancing, but you're going to do it. If you're producing a record, it's done already. It's done.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I love that. I love that. There's nothing to do and everything gets done. I might need to put that on my own wall, actually. All right. Thank you so much, Susan. It's been such a pleasure and it's been lovely chatting to you. So really appreciate it.
Thank you. And my warmest regards to wherever you are in Australia. I love Australia.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Thank you.
My biggest three takeaways from Susan's episode was firstly, that art is all about communication. So there is no fear of AI taking the place of humans because AI doesn't have something that it wants to convey to its listeners. My second biggest takeaway was that this is not the first time that we've been fearful of new technology in music, and that when synthesis first started, the musicians union were actually punishing musicians for using it out of fear that it will take the jobs of musicians. My last takeaway was the importance of community, and that now is an excellent time for us as women in music to network amongst ourselves and to support each other. That's it from us this week. I hope you enjoyed the episode, and we look forward to seeing you in 2 weeks.